California, Nevada, and a number of other states have record early voting. The mystery is who those voters are. On Insight, our election week begins with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken joins us tomorrow night for live election coverage, too. Then new research on the voting power of Latina voters. Dr. Mindy Romero is back with information on what's called the untapped Latina and Latino voting power in recent elections. In our second half hour, painter Maya Lowe. She has a solo show this weekend in Placer County. We'll talk about her journey through breast cancer, too. And then poet Ray Guiron reads from her two new poetry collections. She teaches writing at UC Davis. She has taught hundreds of students in her independent workshops, maybe even you. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Voter registration and early voting are record-breaking this year. California says 19.6 million voters are registered. Nevada reports 1.5 million. So let's say Texas is reporting early voting records. Add Florida, Wisconsin, and Ohio to the list. Minnesota and Iowa are on track for the same number. The list of states is long. Tomorrow, of course, is midterm election day across the United States. Cap Radio and NPR will begin live coverage at 5 o'clock, and the political junkie Ken Rudin will join us from the Washington, D.C. area. Of course, it's Monday, so we're going to start this hour in a conversation with Ken, our regular weekly chat. Hi, Ken.
This is my favorite time of year, Beth. Hi, Beth.
I know. This is your Super Bowl, but let me start with this. When has a midterm election been as consequential as this one could be?
Well, that's a good question because, you know, every time is a midterm election, we always say, oh, this is the most consequential in history.
Right.
And, you know, often we do say that. In 2006, during 6 years after George W. Bush, the midterm elections were very important about the conduct of the war in Iraq and the response to Katrina and rising prices. In 2010, Barack Obama's first midterm election, it was consequential because of, you know, it was going to be a verdict on Obama, whose numbers were not good, and Obamacare, which was still in its early stages. So all those things, all those previous midterm elections were very consequential. Having said that, this is a big one because, you know, you have a president whose numbers are hovering around 40-45%, which is not too dissimilar to what it was with Barack Obama in 2010. But the difference is that there's a toxicity in this election, in the rhetoric and the kind of rallies you hear around the country that are frightening people. There are questions about the future of women's reproductive rights and immigration reform and things like that. So is it consequential? It absolutely is. It is the most ever. We like to think it is. It certainly is very consequential, and it certainly could give us a signal of what it's going to be like for the next 2 years of the Trump term.
But Ken, the dramatic difference is early voting and these record high numbers of people registering. The mystery, though, is which party is so motivated? And are these young voters, are they unlikely voters? Are they non-white voters? Who is making up all these numbers across the country?
These are great, great and important questions because every year, every cycle, and we can go back, you know, to decades, we always talk about the youth vote and will the youth come out and vote? And even when they lowered the voting age in 1971 and when Nixon and McGovern were running in 72, everybody said, let's watch the youth vote. And every time that doesn't seem to be the case. This time, especially in the aftermath of the horrific killings in Parkland, Florida, in the school shootings, we've heard more and more young people saying, this time, we're not going to leave it up to the so-called adults. We're going to take elections in our own hands, and we're going to vote. And at least anecdotal evidence, if you look at the lines around the country, which are sometimes enormous, hours long, in early voting, there seems to be an enthusiasm that we haven't seen in a long, long time. Now, I will say that in the aftermath of the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination, Republican enthusiasm has increased as well. For a long time, we were talking about the Democratic blue wave. Republicans are saying, wait a second, we vote too, and we're angry too, and we have something to say as well. So So right now, I think there's a little more of an enthusiasm advantage for the Democrats, but that gap is shrinking. And my goodness, it's going to be so many close races that, again, with a day to go, we still have no idea who's going to win.
I'm so curious about which way the women's vote goes in this country, too. And you're right, heavy turnout typically favors Democrats. But this seems to be such a different era. And I think the reason that we're all wondering what's going to happen is that the polls went in such a different direction by a majority in the 2016 elections that polls almost seem a factor to look at, but less predictive than they ever were before.
I agree completely, because the one thing polls do not show, it does not show enthusiasm. It does not show turnout. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, there's regular voters and there's likely voters. But there's also something called certain voters, and we don't know if they're certain voters until they show up to vote. So, yes, you know, look, on the day of the election, and, you know, Beth, we've been talking about this for at least 2 years, for the day of the election, 2016, I couldn't see a path for Donald Trump to win the presidency. Did not see him winning Pennsylvania, Ohio, well, maybe Ohio, but certainly not Michigan and Wisconsin. And there with the ball game right there. So, of course, the difference, of course, is this is not a national election. These are 35 individual races for the Senate, 36 individual races for governor, all 435 House seats. And you know, what could be a big red wave in states like North Dakota, for example, may not be the same case in states like California. So, you know, everybody, and that's what's fascinating about tomorrow night. You know, there are different time zones where we can see indications of what might happen. The fact that Indiana closes at 6 p.m. Eastern, we may know if Democrat Senator Joe Donnelly gets defeated. But later in the evening, with Arizona and California and Nevada and states like that, there could be other, you know, changes to the blue side. So it's going to be a long night and an exciting night.
So, of course, there are a lot of key local issues. I want to sum up what we're going to be watching very closely out here in the West in terms of national races. The Democrats need to flip 23 seats to take control of the House, and California has a number of those. And we're the latest in terms of the polling out here. So it could be 5 seats, it could be 7 that make the decision. So that's key for the House. Looking at the Senate, perhaps the most vulnerable seat in the country is just across the border in Nevada. So there's a race there that the whole country is going to be watching.
Certainly the one in Nevada is the most vulnerable Republican. Most vulnerable senator is Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, a Democrat seeking a second term. I think she goes down to defeat, but with Dean Heller in Nevada, first of all, he barely won in 2012. He's the only Republican senator running in a state that was won by Hillary Clinton. The polls show it dead even, or maybe Heller with a point or two over Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Rosen. So, boy, that is going to be a close race, a large Latino constituency that could affect the ballgame, too. And Heller is not the darling of every Republican. Remember, for the longest time, he was very wary, if not opposed to Donald Trump as a candidate and President Trump as a president. And then when conservatives started talking about mounting a conservative challenge to Heller in the primary, he moved closer and closer to Trump. So Heller has it's a tough tightrope for him to walk. He can't go too far right, or he'll alienate all the Democrats there. He can't go too far left, or the conservatives will sit home. I don't envy Dean Heller tomorrow, even if he does win.
Nevada has an important governor's race, too, and that brings up the point that President Trump and former President Barack Obama were stumping this weekend and paying a lot of time and energy and focus in some of the governor's races.
You know something, we always focus on, we've been focusing on the battle for the House. The Democrats need 23 seats. We've been focusing on the battle for the Senate. Right now it's only 51-49 Republican, and we should be focusing on that. But we forget that in the gubernatorial races around the country, the 36 of them, first of all, of the 36 that are up, 26 are now held by Republicans, only 9 by Democrats, which gives the Democrats more targets and more opportunities to win. plus the fact that we forget that it's the governors around the country, as well as the state legislatures, that will decide they will draw the congressional districts after the 2020 census. So for all we talk about, oh, everything is gerrymandered and my vote doesn't count because of redistricting and partisan gerrymandering, the gubernatorial races around the country are crucial. For example, if Democrats do pickups in those races around the country, they could win Wisconsin. They'll probably win Illinois. They'll probably win Michigan, other states as well. They could win Georgia, which is a very closely watched race. Florida, they could win. That could change the drawings of the congressional district lines after 2020.
Let me back up a minute to the battle for the House, because Kevin McCarthy, Nancy Pelosi, whichever way the party shift or doesn't shift happens in the House plays big in terms of California leadership in Congress. And I think it's worth saying something about that, because that's pivotal. Nancy Pelosi is not guaranteed, if the House Democrats win, that she will return to being Speaker of the House.
That's a very important point. I mean, she's been the Democratic leader in the House for the longest time. She became Speaker after the Democrats won the House in 2006. But there are more and more Democratic candidates around the country, especially in kind of purplish districts and even red districts, where the Democratic candidates are saying, under no circumstances will I be voting for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker, because, you know, we need new leadership. She's 78 years old, and I don't want to play the age issue, but you know, there are a lot of young Democrats out there chomping at the bit and, you know, hoping for a new kind of younger leadership. So she's not guaranteed. And I just wonder about Kevin McCarthy, too. He's the likely front runner if the Republicans win that control the House, or even if they're in the minority, he could be the minority leader. But again, you know, that unbelievable tweet he sent out last week about, you know, whether Steyer, Bloomberg, and Soros are going to buy the election, which many people around the country took as a dog whistle for anti-Semitism, that hurt McCarthy. I don't know if that's going to hurt his chances of leading the Republicans, but I would say that no matter what happens on Tuesday in the battle for the House, neither Nancy Pelosi nor Kevin McCarthy is guaranteed of being the leader of their party.
Nate Silver, on his 538 political website, is giving a 4 in 5 chance, 81%, that the Democrats win control of the House, just a 1 in 5, 19% that the Republicans do. But his quote over the weekend, Ken, was that there is a wide range of outcomes in the House, that it's really wide. And that speaks statistically to how many variations there are in the scenario tomorrow on Election Day.
Well, that's why my answer is always going to be, don't pay attention to Nate Silver. Don't pay attention to Ken Rudin. Don't pay attention to those who saying this will happen or that will happen. Just vote.
Just make sure
you vote. Don't do what a lot of people did in 2016, that they whined and moaned about the result. And they said, oh, did you vote? And they said, no. So you got to go out and vote. But regarding the battle for the House, you can't overemphasize the importance of California in this, because there, as you said earlier in the show, there are at least 5, 6, or 7 House seats that are at the worst dead even. These are Republican House seats that are at the worst dead even, and the best scenario for the Democrats, they could pick up 1 or 2. Right now, I think they're guaranteed to pick up the Darrell Issa's seat, the 49th district in Southern California. But there are at least 5 or 6 other Republican seats that the Republicans are no better than even in that. And again, if the Democrats are going to get their 23 seats to put them in the majority, one place to look is California. And as you said, pointed out earlier, it'll be a late night, because California, we don't know until 11 o'clock Eastern what's going to happen there. And then we first have to first start counting. There are no exit polls in House races, so we may be up all night Tuesday night to see who wins control of the House.
Well, out here we do have good weather. It's going to be dark earlier in the evening because of our time change, but weather can be a factor. You know, Ken, often in our conversations we spend time on the president and his choices, and I don't want to do that today. I just want to leave the point with go vote, go cast your ballot. However you do it, wherever you do it, make sure your vote happens and that it can count.
and especially be aware of the efforts around the country to either curtail the vote or intimidate people not to vote or outright voter suppression. It's a sacred right that we have. Take advantage of it. You got to vote. And it doesn't matter if you vote Democratic, Republican, third party, you know, the United Martian Party. It doesn't really matter. Just make sure you vote on Tuesday. And then we'll see what happens. And then we'll start this process all over again for 2020, which you know will begin on Wednesday morning.
You will be here with us for the play-by-play tomorrow night, by phone anyway, not in person. We will look forward.
I want to be there in person.
2020, we'll make that happen.
I'll start driving now.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Beth. Have a good night tomorrow.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie, and our election coverage tomorrow night, which includes Ken among our analysts, starts at 5 p.m. Live results and analysis and online blogging. You can find it all at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In my conversation just now with the political junkie Ken Rudin, you heard a reference to the influence that Latina voters, especially in California and Nevada, might have. Mindy Romero is joining me to focus more on this group of voters. Mindy is the executive director and founder of the California Civic Engagement Project, which is based at USC's Sacramento campus. Hi, Mindy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
When you hear record numbers in registration and early voting, do you immediately think that must be a tap into voters who are, let's say, non-white overall?
Yes, generally it is. When we see registration go up, we're registering the population that isn't registered, and that is overwhelmingly of color, Latino and Asian American.
How about young voters?
It also, the non-registered voter population is disproportionately young. So when we register more people, it also means we're registering more young people. As a matter of fact, though, we've actually crunched some of the numbers in terms of the latest registration rates. So that 19.6 million is huge.
In California.
Is a record in terms of total numbers. But, of course, the population is always growing, too. So you really have to look at registration rate, which is the percentage of those who are eligible to register. What does that look like? So the Secretary of State has reported that we're at 78%, which is absolutely huge to be going into a midterm with. But disparities still remain, and this would be expected, but we should note. So for Latinos, the registration rate right now currently is 67%. For young people, it's age 18 to 24, it's 59%. So we still have disparities. We're still going into an election with, for instance, young people, 40% of them not registered to vote. But there is one difference, though, in this election, since you mentioned registration, I have to say this. Now we have something called conditional voter registration in California, or same-day voter registration. So even though we've passed the official deadline and our reported registration is locked in, these are our rates formally that we have, you can still register. It's a little bit more difficult. You can't just go online, and if you go online and you register, it's not going to count for this election. But you can go to any elections office, and if you're in a Voters Choice Act county like Sacramento or Nevada, you can go to any vote center, and you can conditionally both register and vote. So it's not too late to get registered.
You need some paperwork with you, though, right?
Yes. You need to. So it's conditional, so they will verify that later to make sure that it was appropriate that you were registering and that your vote counts. But you are able to register and to vote.
Can I take you back to 2016 so we have some comparison? We're talking about, if we just focus on the Latino voter block, what was 2016? And does that emphasize how big the gap or the jump is now going into tomorrow in 2018?
Sure. So, you know, 2016 was, generally speaking, if we're looking at the United States, the turnout was about 61%. It was about flat with 2012, which might surprise some people because for many, this was a very consequential election, right, 2 years ago. The Latino vote was 48%. We're talking about of eligible voters, citizen voting age. So there was a significant gap. There always is. The turnout rate for Latinos was about flat over 2012. In California, we saw a little bit better year for Latinos, and that showed up in their share of the vote, which was the highest ever that we've seen. But we didn't see huge numbers.
No surge.
No huge surge. Yeah, and we didn't see a huge surge for the population as a whole, again, despite what I think maybe some common perceptions were around the election. And now going into the midterm, of course, turnout rates for everyone are always lower. Number one, they usually don't approach anywhere near a presidential. This year, I think we will have a good year for turnout, but it'll be within that context of what's possible for a midterm. And then disparities across groups by race, ethnicity, age, pretty much you name it, are always greater in a midterm. So the gap between, so let's say, whites and Latinos is also greater in a midterm, and it's more challenging generally for voters of color and for young people to get out and vote and to impact an election. Although, again, and I think you just had this conversation, there's a lot to indicate in this election that we probably will see a good year overall, and I think a good representation for Latinos. And our latest research shows that Latinos will be a significant factor in that, and certainly in the now 7 congressional districts in California that are hotly, mm-hmm. hotly mm-hmm. contested, but also hotly watched. We know that Latinos as a whole make up really large proportions of voters and eligible voters in those districts. 3 of them, around 30%. And Latinas specifically, because they vote in larger percentages than Latinos and Latino men, they are actually driving the vote. So if we're talking about, so there's the story of disparity, which is constant for the Latino vote. But there is also the story where we see women are voting more than men. That's true as a whole in the United States, but Latinas particularly are voting more than Latinos. And when we're talking about the battle for control of Congress, as you were just talking about, not going to win the House without going through California, and you're not going to win those 7 districts without mobilizing and reaching out in a significant way to the Latino community, and you have to do it through also Latinas because they're driving many of the changes, the growth that we see in terms of the Latino vote as a whole, and they're also a large section or larger proportion of the Latino vote in all of those districts. Does that make sense?
It does, but add to this the narrative that's going on right now from the president. The visuals of the caravan, the discussion mm-hmm. of the caravan, the pictures of military forces being mobilized, the stories we had earlier this year of families being stopped and divided at the borders. It would seem obvious that that's going to play heavily in the motivation to vote, to make your presence sure. count in this country. How heavily do you see that as a factor that maybe is distinctive to this year, a spike this year, but maybe not overall indicative?
Oh, that's a really great question. So first off, I think certainly, as we call it, the Trump factor and everything, the rhetoric and everything that, as you just laid out around that, is definitely a concern and a factor specifically with the Latino vote. But in 2 ways. So it's individual Latinos and in their communities, you know, hearing this and being concerned and also living the policies of the Trump administration. That's a big difference from 2016. There was concern around a potential Trump presidency for many in the Latino community, but now people are living those policies, right? But then there's also very much a factor of the leadership in the Latino community, the nonprofit, nonpartisan groups that do outreach and mobilization. So it's the work that they do, right, that activates and mobilizes the Latino community. And so it's really up to them in terms of how much they're able to do. And there is a lot of good work out there. But I will note that, again, this year, this is just always the case. The amount of investment, the money, right, the resources that go into mobilizing the Latino community are always far less than it should be. And there's always this lost opportunity. So even as we see growing Latino voters in terms of numbers, even as when we see bumps and increased turnout, there's still many, many more Latinos that could be mobilized. And they're not. And we hear just recently from Latino Decisions and Aleo, a tracking poll again, showing that 62% of registered Latinas say said that they received no contact or had not been contacted by a campaign candidate or any other organization regarding the election. And a little bit less for men. For Latino men, but really high numbers. And those numbers are similar in California, a little different, but similar. So there is how people are feeling about the election. And by the way, this goes for other groups as well. Young people, women, any group that we're talking about in this election, and we're saying they could potentially make a difference or come out in bigger numbers. There's how groups are feeling, but then they need to be activated and mobilized. They actually have to be, you can have these concerns, and you can actually be paying more attention to the election, and you could actually be saying that you want to vote. And all those numbers have been increasing. But we still have to actually reach out to them and help them become voters and activate them into being voters. And that's the thing that I think that we often forget, and we set these expectations for groups. But it really comes down to how good are the get out the vote efforts, the mobilization efforts to help people actually get out and participate.
Which is why as a group, this voting group, men and women, is still considered untapped in terms of its potential.
Yes. But again, they are voting. There are disparities. And that's what's actually significant in the growth of the Latino vote, particularly here in California. In 2016, it was 22% of all voters, even with disparities, even with these differences in turnout rates. Latinos are still having an impact. We don't want to lose that in the narrative. They are having a significant impact. Again, we'll have an impact in these congressional district races, certainly. But there's so much more of an impact compared to their numbers that they could be having, right, to their proportions of the population. And it really is an investment and a mobilization story. Young people also report not getting very much outreach and education and mobilization in elections.
Mindy, there's so much data here. We're going to link all three reports, and I'll recite the title of the reports in case one of them or all of them pique your interest. They are The Strength of the Latino Vote, Current and Future Impact on the U.S. Political Landscape. The second report is Midterm Elections, Latino Vote Hotspots. And this recent report is titled The Strength of the Latina Vote, the Women's Vote, Gender Differences in Latino Voting Participation. I think there's a whole hour we could do on this.
I think so.
But we're going to get so much more information after tomorrow.
We will. And as Ken said, you know, we really don't know what that, we can't predict those numbers. It really is now a ground game, and it has been in California for a little while. I think there's a lot to, a lot of expectations out there, and a lot of it is about managing those expectations. I think we'll see a good turnout, but how good is yet to be seen.
All right, Mindy, that begs a follow-up, and we will have it sometime in the future. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mindy Romero is director and founder of the California Civic Engagement Project. Those links will be at capradio.org/insight, and this is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Painter Maya Lowe has never joined us in the studio before, but she has a different story to tell now than she might have a few years ago. I first met Maya because her beautiful paintings were being auctioned every year for the Placer Breast Cancer Endowment, and she wanted to help, though she had never experienced the disease herself. Not at that point, anyway. So I think I'll pause there and introduce Maya. So good to have you here. Glad to welcome you to Insight.
Beth, thank you. It is such a delight to be here and a great honor. Thank you very much for hosting me.
You were born in Holland. You lived and studied art all over the world. When did you come to Northern California?
Approximately 30 years ago, but via South Africa. Most of my education was in Cape Town, and I met my husband there, Etienne, and learned to speak English there. So that's why I have this very strange accent, even though I have lived here for 30 years and love it. They're going to have to take me out of a box from California. I'm never going anywhere anymore. This is where it's all at. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the first piece of art that inspired you or woke you up to grand, majestic artwork?
Oh, I love that. I wish I could lay claim to grand majestic artwork, but certainly my best recollection ever was 10 years of age going with my parents to the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and discovering The Night Watch by Rembrandt. Mm-hmm. 10 years old, sitting there in the room and just being overawed by the sheer magnificence of that painting. And if at all I can recommend it, to place that in your bucket list, visit Amsterdam and the Rijksmuseum, because it's still the most amazing painting ever. So yes, I started at about the age of 10 starting to draw, and at the age of 13, my formal career started, just learning to draw and draw and draw and paint, and it slowly started from there.
You are part of the Placer Arts Council studio tour this weekend. If people come to see your work, they will see a real variety here, because with what you just said, your work evolved into landscapes. But there's also a group of paintings that you've done with your magnificent ladies that we'll talk about in a moment. But how did your interests diverge like this?
Well, it's basically my bread and butter was always my landscapes. And having been a professional artist, by that I mean that I actually earned my living from it. People always say, well, what is a professional? I say, I had to earn my living from it. It's not just painting on Sundays. It's actually living and eating and working at my craft each and every day as most that I could with young children at the time. But yes, 35 years as a professional artist, that's what I've done. And the monotony of that created the yin to the yang, which are the ladies, so that I could have an outlet of fun and not just work-related landscapes, which were the Northern California landscapes, which I absolutely love doing. But you need to have a little bit of variety, I think, sometimes.
Now we're kind of walking into that storyline that I set up, because these ladies are so fun. They have a pose or a pout. They can be a little bit curious or provocative. The colors are vibrant and beautiful. And as I said, I first saw your work in relation to the endowment, the fundraising that was going on for a research position at the UC Davis Cancer Center. And what connected you there? Why were your ladies just right for the pink group?
Wow, Beth, you know, that's a wonderful question. And a little bit, how can I say, when I look back at my life, that was a little bit of serendipity, but possibly not in a good way. However, I am so happy that I had the chance to do that before I got sick. And we did raise the $1.5 million, as you know, and it was just lovely to be able to contribute these ladies, which then went on to various postcards. And the actual painting is I believe, at the UC Davis
Breast Cancer Center.
The clinic, yes. And it was donated to the clinic after using it for 5 years for all the various public marketing materials. So for me, it was just a most delightful way to get the ladies recognized, and but in a good way. They're a little bit sexy, but they're also quite plumpish, and they have their eyes closed, so that you are actually forced to look at their body language rather than their eyes. The eyes tell too much sometimes, and I wanted to relate the body and the language of the body and showing what the lady was trying to say to the audience.
I tweeted a picture of your painting. In fact, brought it in this morning. The one that I own, because I love her. She's a lovely character. So you can see that at Cap Radio Ruyak. Then what happened? The money was raised. You had done this work, and you said you got sick.
Wow. Yes, I got breast cancer and had to undergo a double mastectomy. And all those lovely ladies that I worked with at the endowment center, they were there for me. And it was a very harrowing time. My whole universe rocked. It just tilted upside down. Had a huge influence on my work because my work has definitely changed. It's had a huge influence on my psyche. I think if you're in pain, and I was in a lot of pain, unfortunately, it does change your psyche. And with that comes another insight into my work and how I project it. My landscapes have softened. They are totally different to 5-7 years ago, and I'm so excited about that. The ladies, on the other hand, they're still there. You know, they just pop up and they're in my subconscious, and they haven't shifted much in what I've been doing for the last 15, 20 years in the ladies. So, but the landscapes have definitely altered. Also because my venue is different. I have another studio in Bodega Bay. It's beautiful. It was designed by my very talented husband, Etienne, who's an architect. And it's right on the beach at Wright's Beach, overlooking the beach. And that has also largely influenced my work. And I'm hoping that people who come in through the tour next weekend will enjoy my new work. I had a show which has just come down at the Blue Line Arts Gallery, which was, I think, fairly successful. So that was a huge relief, so that my new work was sort of accepted. And I've got a long way to go to make that work really, really so much better. I've got lots of work ahead of me.
It sounds as though you're working as much as you ever did. Mm. Are you in a full remission now? How is your health?
Beth, you know, it's too early to tell. You know, unfortunately, there's medications that I'm on and infusions, and so probably, hopefully, in 3 years' time. But I don't think about it. I don't mind talking about it because there's a lot that I can help other women with, and I would like to. You know, certainly as far as what indications I had, which are totally different to anybody else that I've ever spoken to. So there are a couple of things that I would like other women to know and understand about what they may go through if they, you know, have all the surgeries. Yes. My surgeons, by the way, were fantastic. I mean, gosh, they were wonderful. But at the end of the day, it's a huge undertaking to have a double mastectomy and reconstruction thereafter.
I do want to thank you for saying yes to this conversation today, because I do think it takes a measure of courage to be where you want to be now, which is open, as open about your health and your life journey as you have been about your art and the giving mm-hmm. of your art. So let me wrap up with one final question, which is, what has risen higher in terms of importance in your life? What do you see differently in any realm because of the skewed view that the cancer journey has given you?
I think my bucket list, for example, grows by the minute. That's the big thing, is to make sure that each and every day there's something wonderful to look forward to, whether it's having lunch with a girlfriend or a drink with my husband or speaking to my children in Denmark and New York because they're far afield, and enjoying my grandchildren now. Very, very important. But every day, a smile on the face and just soldier on. What else can we do as cancer survivors? You just carry on and don't think too much about it. Just, I'm not brave. Not at all. But I do have a sense of humor, and I think that takes me a long, long way.
Maya, I think people would be delighted to meet you in person and to see your work. So I will say again that the Placer Arts Studio Tour is from November 9th to the 11th,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
It's hosted by the Placer County Arts Council. Your studio is on Auburn Folsom Road behind the Granite Bay Post Office.
Yes, right? And I'm number 32 on the tour map, and everyone is most welcome. I love making new friends. I've got many friends that have been on the tour with me, come to visit each year, so I'm hoping I'm going to make many more this time round, this year round. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you here. I'm so glad to see you doing well.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you very much.
That is painter Maya Lowe. We have posted more images online, and again, you can see one of her paintings in my tweet, at Cap Radio Ruyak. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio, I'm Beth Ruyak. Usually, news of an artist's double release means two albums by a musician, right? Well, in this case, it's books by a popular award-winning poet. Her name is Rae Guiron. She teaches poetry and creative nonfiction at UC Davis, and her two new collections are titled Must Apple and Glass is Glass, Water is Water. There is a double release party Thursday at Morgan's Mill in Woodland, and I am so excited to have Rae in the studio. Welcome to Insight. I'm so glad you're here today.
Hi, Beth. I'm so happy to be here.
How did this happen, and how rare is it for a poet to release two collections at the same time?
I can't think of another poet in my lifetime that has released two books literally on top of each other. It's completely coincidental, the timing of the releases lining up like this, and the lives of the books, the processes by which they got written were so completely different from one another. I never could have guessed that they would end up emerging at the same time.
One is short term with one focus, the other longer term with an entirely different perspective.
Completely different.
Do you want to explain the two?
A long time now, ever since my first book came out, have been working between multiple projects at all times. It's always made a lot of sense to me to have a project on the front burner, a project on the side burner, a project on the counter waiting to move onto a burner. Glass is Glass, Water is Water is a book that I started very consciously about five and a half years ago, worked on very slowly. Must Apple started last year when I was doing a residency in Oysterville, Washington, and it came together in record time. It's a much shorter book, but my experiences of the two books coming together is so different. I'm honestly a little shocked that inside of a year, I had two wildly divergent experiences with bringing them to completion.
I've read the description for Must Apple, and in reading some of the poetry, it does match that it's a love letter, really, mm-hmm. to summertime in mm-hmm. Sacramento. And is it true that the first publisher who received it said, yes, I want
yes.
this?
Yes.
Not true for Glass is Glass, Water is Water. And that's going to be published by Spork Press out of Tucson, Arizona.
Yes.
And
yes.
So talk about the focus there, which is heavier, deeper. Love and loss and metaphor.
They say that all poems are about love and death, and I definitely agree with that. I have a hard time not seeing love and death inside of basically all creative work. But Glass is Glass, Water is Water is concerned basically with two things, figuration, metaphor, figurative language, and the ways that I see it failing. As opposed to the ways that I see it succeeding or helping to feed the work of poetry. And the spaces in relationships that cannot be resolved between people, simultaneous truths, irresolvable differences. There are a number of poems in Glass is Glass, Water is Water that actually cannot be read aloud because they are composed of simultaneous texts. You can't choose one over the other and end up reading the poem as presented on the page. So,
Your poetry is deep and strong. I think a class could spend an hour on six of your lines. Is that what happens in some of your classes? Do you work on some of your own work?
That's a really good question. Invisibly, I end up working on my own work while I'm teaching all the time. And that's one of the things that I love about teaching is that it enables me to sort of never get out of the water fully. Mm. But I've never taught my own work. I've definitely talked about it in classrooms where I've been invited to be a guest speaker. But usually I have more the experience of learning from what it is that my students are struggling with or discovering in real time and realizing quietly, you know, behind the curtain of the teaching seat, what it is that's there for me to remember too.
And to your point about everything being about love and loss and living and dying, even Must Apple, in the discussion of harvest and the change of landscape, in your poetry about pomegranates and figs, there is that same sort of framing that you give it, even though if you're not paying attention, you might not know.
Mm-hmm.
What are you writing now?
That's also a really great question. I am working on a new full-length collection about the history of paper. I am also working on a book-length poem that started getting born for me completely unexpectedly last spring, right after the poet Lucy Brock-Broido died. And I am working on a long-term nonfiction project, a memoir that I'm working on very, very slowly, that's been on the furthest back of the back burners for probably about 7 or 8 years now.
So I'm talking with poet Ray Guiron. And your name, I should spell for people in case they try to look it up. They'll say, what is she saying? G-O-U-I-R-A-N-D. Mm-hmm. A French name.
A French name.
That can be challenging.
Indeed.
And am I saying it the way you say it?
It's perfect.
Okay. I also want to mention your 2011 collection, the one you referred to as the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It's titled Open Winter. And it was chosen for the 2011 Belday Prize. Your work has been published far and wide, but there was no published book or collection between that one and these two.
No, just Genesis.
So the release party will be at 7 p.m. on Thursday at Morgan's Mill. This is a little, what, a coffee wine bar?
It's a coffee wine bar in the Old Globe Rice Mill building. It's a really cool spot.
And I think because you teach and write in so many voices, I'm curious about what you've come to learn about yourself and how you see the world.
Through these two books specifically?
Yeah, because they are two different positions in where you are right now as a person.
I think my honest answer is that I would gain nothing by pretending to be any less serious than I am about everything. Mm-hmm. That's what it all boils down to for me at this point in my life.
There are writers far and wide in this region who have learned from you, because besides UC Davis, you've taught independent workshops that I think for the most part have waiting lists, dozens and dozens of people who, before I'd ever met you, have said, oh, I was one of Ray's students. I learned from Ray. Tell me what's been captivating and energizing about those independent workshops.
It's almost indescribable. I was very lucky to get a vision at a very young age of what education could look like outside of the walls of a school. And I don't think that I realized it consciously in the first writing workshops that I participated in, that was a really powerful seed that had been planted. But it is remarkable to me what happens when a group of people come together consciously with intentions, wanting to bring themselves into clearer and more consistent conversation with their inner lives and with the parts of themselves that cannot be spoken in everyday transactional discourse. And it's completely transforming to live a life where I am constantly surrounded by people who are in pursuit of their creative projects, of creative ways of being, of more integrated, more wholly integrated selfhood. I think I have gained more from becoming a teacher, I've learned more about how to be a self than I could imagine learning any other way. This is definitely the path I was supposed to end up on and supposed to pursue.
Does that mean that you talk more or listen more as a teacher?
Depends on the day. Yeah, really depends on the day. I have a lot to say, and I'm not always good about remembering to open my ears and close my mouth at particular moments, but I am definitely there in the circle to hear as much as I am to speak.
The books are just being printed, so where will they be available?
They will be available in person on the night of the release party on Thursday night. Thereafter, Must Apple will be available on Amazon. You can just search for the title. The Spork book, Glass is Glass, Water is Water, will only be available for Spork on pre-order for a minute. It actually doesn't get released until December 1st officially.
Love that we got a little preview.
Yeah.
Next time, and there will be a next time, you come back and read, okay?
I would love to.
Ray Guiron. The new books will be talked more about on our website. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.